Where do I put this fire? This bright red feeling. This tiger lily down my mouth. He wants to grow to 20 feet tall. I've left Bethlehem and I feel free. I've left the girl I was supposed to be. Someday I'll be born. I'm so tired of being shy. I'm not that girl anymore. I'm not that straight A anymore. Now I wanna sit my legs wide open and laugh so loud that the whole damn restaurant will turn and look at me. Look at the tiger jumping out of her mouth.
Just what is sacred? Places, religious tenets, deities, ideas, and of course, what makes any of these things potentially sacred anyway? I first felt some sense of the sacred when I was in the outdoors. It was soon after that discovery of sacredness of place, and not just one place, but many places, as long as these places were natural and wild, that I found that symbology and ritual started to really make sense. I felt a need to recognize and to honor that sacredness. Today on Yin Radio, we're going to explore the sacred with three women, an ex-Mormon, a Muslim, and a Buddhist. However, religion isn't always the focus of the topic of sacredness. I do have three installments today that bring three different discussions on what is sacred. The women in each installment have a number of things in common. They all see themselves as feminists. They were all raised with mainstream American religious values, and all have searched for and found paths that are not what their parents would have chosen for them. They approach what is sacred in very different ways. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio, and I'm Sandy Billings. Our program today is about the sacred.
Once told me that nothing ever stays the same, but I believe the sacred does, and it will make you weep.
Installment number one. Taryn Magrini works for the Idaho Women's Network. It's one of Idaho's oldest and largest women-led organizations, at only 20 years old. The Idaho Women's Network is a direct advocacy, organizing, research, and education organization. And it works with public outreach and political arenas so it can influence policies that affect women, families, and communities. Taryn Magrini talked with Yin Radio's Anna Maria Roque this past December about the basic tenets that drive her, and about how she holds these tenets sacred, above any religious views. Here's Taryn Magrini.
Now, I don't know actually how much you know about social work, but, you know, social work is actually based on seven core values. And when I was learning about these values, they were values that were already reflected in me. So it wasn't that I had to change my values to fit my profession. I managed to find a profession that reflected my own personal values. Things like the importance of human relationships, self-determination, competence, service. I know it's social justice isn't one of them, but it's something like that. Human relationships and self-determination actually are always the first two on my mind is, this is a bit of a tangent, but there's a struggle with social workers and gay rights, actually. And it's something I feel very, very strongly about. So social workers all, I think, join social work wanting to do good, but everyone comes from a different place and has their own set of values, and I don't think all people quite have the fit that I did almost instantly. you actually have people who, for various reasons personally or based on their, you know, religious values, don't, you know, it's not that they don't necessarily, I don't want to speak for anyone, but there has a tendency to be sort of an anti-gay climate among certain religious groups. So you have social workers who are religious and they have to sort of fight, they have this conflict within them. And to me, it shouldn't be a conflict. I actually just got a survey via email that I participated in just on this subject. It was this kind of scenario where, you know, this person is a social worker and they get, I think in this scenario, they work for some adoption agency or Department of Health and Welfare or something like that. And they get this case file, or they're doing a home visit and they're not allowed to know anything about the people, so they have no preconceived notions. And they do a home visit and find out that the couple is actually a same-sex couple, and how would they react? And I was just so offended at the fact that that we even have to have a survey like this, because to me, you know, you should hold, as a professional, as a social worker, you should hold those values so highly that it shouldn't be a question in your mind. I mean, when you sign on to be a social worker, you should have these seven values and hold nothing above them. And self-determination and the importance of human relationships, you know, by those values, then you should support gay marriage. I sort of forgot where I was going with that. But it's been a big issue. I'm the legislative chairperson for the National Association of Social Workers, so it comes up a lot. And I feel very strongly about this, so I always have to sort of watch my language and my attitude, because I will, if a social worker, a young social worker, were to come to me with this dilemma, I might actually refer them to someone else, because I'll have a tendency to say, you know, pull your head out of your butt. You're a social worker first. I don't want to hear anything else. But I believe very strongly in the code. You know, the code is my Bible.
Do you have any religious background yourself?
I do, actually. I was raised LDS.
Not anymore.
I am no longer LDS. So I've got that sort of ex-Mormon thing going for me, I believe. But my family is still LDS, and they're really wonderful people. So
how do they feel about, you know, the things you do?
They're,
You know,
it's funny. I was actually just home for Thanksgiving. I'm like, we have a tendency to not talk about certain things. So, the Proposition 8 was like, I'm not even gonna bring it up. Like, I love my family, and I know we stand on different places. So I'm from Idaho Falls. I did briefly mention how I was putting on lotion and I saw it was from Melaleuca, and I'm like, oh, I can't be using this, I'm boycotting Melaleuca. And my dad looks at me and he's like, why? You know, why ever would you boycott Melaleuca? It's, you know, it's this huge company. My mom used to work there. And I'm like, well, you know, the whole Proposition 8 thing. And I'm like, yeah, and I'm just going to leave that and walk into the living room. I'm like, that's not a debate. And when it, you know, I only get to see my family like 1 week a year. Like, I'm not having this conversation with them. My mom's actually this really wonderful, sweet person, and I know that it's not even secretly, she really is very sort of a social justice-minded person. You know, she hates things that aren't fair, and I think almost on every issue, you know, maybe not gay marriage per se, but like the bill I'm working on, she completely agrees with. So, the Idaho Human Rights Act. So, you just have to frame it in a certain way with her. I'm like, well, do you think it's fair that people should be fired just because they're gay or lesbian? She's like, well, no. I'm like, see? So I think if you put things a certain way, she really gets it. And I love that about her, so. I have a tendency to not want to challenge her too much because, you know, I've been slowly picking away at her over the years, getting her to think about things from this angle or that angle, so.
Taryn McGreeny is the Public Policy Director for the Idaho Women's Network, based in Boise, Idaho. She talked with Yen Radio's Anna Maria Roque this past December. Now, Wikipedia says that the Arabic word for, that hijab is the Arabic word for curtain or cover. It's a noun, and it's based on a root word that means to cover, to veil, or to shelter. In popular use, hijab means head cover and modest dress for women among Muslims, which most Islamic legal systems define hijab as covering everything except the face, feet, and hands in public. Installment number 2 on this show about sacred is a conversation that Anna Maria Roque had with an American woman from Idaho who chooses to wear hijab. In Boise, Idaho, where she lives and works, is where she wears hijab. Marissa Kali is the outreach person for the Boise Mosque and Islamic Center in Boise, Idaho. 2 months ago, she talked with Anna Maria Roque about what is most sacred to her, Islam, and being Muslim in America. Marissa talks about dealing with stereotypes and why she, as an Idaho Falls native, chose to convert to Islam and how she's living as a Muslima in Idaho. Her baby son was in the room as well and spoke up from time to time, so you'll hear him babbling and blowing raspberries as well.
Tell me, what's it like to be a Muslim woman in Idaho?
It's a lot different than being a Muslim woman in other places, people
Is
tell
it?
Me. It's I do wear hijab,
okay.
And just when I'm out. Around women, you don't have to.
No.
And but I do wear hijab, and it's definitely an interesting experience. People react very differently. A lot of people will come up and just ask questions. Some people will be very judgmental. I've had people throw cans at me and call me a terrorist and chase me and take pictures of me. And
has gone worse since 9/11, I'm assuming.
Yes. I became Muslim after 9/11.
Okay.
So I didn't really experience pre-9/11. My friends who were Muslim before 9/11 said that it did get a lot worse. And it's kind of... It's a challenge, but I wear it because I believe in educating, and I believe in being Muslim in America is a new challenge, and I wear a hijab because it identifies me as a Muslim. So that means that I am an example of Muslims everywhere, and I want to invite people to come up and ask me questions. It's a good opportunity, and so I enjoy wearing hijab because it encourages people to question and to break stereotypes. I'm actually, with gender studies, I've always considered myself more of a postmodern feminist. I really like Michel Foucault. I did a huge gender studies research project on women legislators, and I've always considered myself a feminist. And wearing hijab, for me, it is empowering. Because in Islam, the purpose of it is because we wear hijab because God tells us so in the Quran. But the reasons that God tells us is because it is empowering.
Mm-hmm.
It allows us to function in a male society completely desexualized because it protects us from being viewed as sexual objects, which means that we can function as equals in society. We can have conversations with men, and we can do all of those things without being viewed as a sexual object. And I also wear it. It's kind of like a symbol for me, much like wearing a crucifix.
Sure.
It reminds me every day to be a better Muslim, and it encourages me to be the best that I can, because it does identify me as a Muslim, so people are always knowing to look at me, and it makes me make sure that I'm being the best that I can every day. I've worn hijab since the day I started work at T-Mobile. I decided that it was a new beginning, and I started wearing it the first day of work, and it's kind of evolved. At first, I didn't know how to tie it. I didn't know what to do, because I was, I'd only been Muslim for about 8 months when I decided to wear hijab, and I hadn't been educated much, so it's been a journey. My job is extremely supportive, They give me a room to pray. They give me breaks to pray.
Oh, yeah.
There was a couple of instances where people have been very intolerant and have said things, and they've taken action. They fired somebody for calling me a bad name. And
that's progressive.
Yeah, they're wonderful. And in a lot of jobs, you actually, I have to write letters for people saying that it's for religious purposes so that they can wear hijab in the workplace. Mm-hmm. But my job, they're completely supportive. So I'm lucky. That's why I don't want to leave.
No, that's great.
I've been offered other positions in my field, but my job is so supportive and they're so progressive that they're so, you know, especially about being Muslim. I don't want to lose that.
So tell me, why did you become a Muslim?
It's actually a very interesting story. I grew up Pentecostal in Idaho Falls. I grew up in a Mormon town, not being Mormon, very, very Christian. And it was, I became very religious until I was about 16. And then my mother had a falling out with our church pastor, and they kicked us out of the church. And suddenly I lost everything. And that was really my break from faith and religion. And suddenly I just became very angry. Then I turned to, I also needed more structure. And so I turned to Catholicism, and I tried that for a while. And then I just became angry again, because I decided that as a woman, religion was oppressive. I went to college at College of Idaho, and I hated religion. I was at that point, I was pagan. I was I hated organized religion. And I took a class from a professor I didn't want to take any religion courses, and they told me I had to. So I took a religion course on theology and the sciences because I thought it would be an opportunity to bash religion.
Mm-hmm.
And it really kind of pushed me back towards the idea of faith rather than religion. And the professor was amazing. He's still one of the most influential people in my life. And he's the reason I became a Muslim, because after that class, I was more open to faith, but I still hadn't gotten to bash anything.
Mm.
So he offered a class on Judaism and Islam, and I'm like, yes, now I can bash Islam for being oppressive towards women and, you know, horrible and critical and abusive and all of these things. So I took the class so that I could specifically do that, because I had all of the misconceptions, the typical misconceptions. And they made me go to the mosque down here, the Islamic Center, and they told me I had to cover my head. And I was insulted. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to wear all black in protest of being being oppressed. They told me I would be in a separate room, and I was furious, and I didn't want to go. And my professor told me if I didn't, I would flunk the class. So I went, and I sat in my car for 20 minutes beforehand, crying, because I was convinced that I was going to go in and be subjugated instantly. And I went in, and I sat in the back of the room, and there was all these women. And they weren't oppressed. They were intelligent. They were empowered. They had their kids. They weren't sitting quietly. They were laughing and talking and helping each other. And there was this sense of community that I'd never imagined. And then afterwards, I sat down with, they had lunch for us. And I sat down and I talked with them, and I asked all of my questions, and they were actually incredibly open. I was angry with them. I was asking all these really tough, angry questions, and they were just very calm, very supportive, and very open. And I came back, and I'm like, well, maybe it's not what I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to go 3 times, and it was during Ramadan, and I went, and they would feed me, and that was a big thing. I was like, wow. This food is amazing. I always tell people I went for the grade and stayed for the food, because there was this community. It wasn't just the food. It was the dinners. It was this sense of community that was just, sorry. It was incredible, because I had left my church devoid of community, and that's really what I'd been looking for. And I found these incredible people, and these women would introduce themselves to me, and they all, the first time I went, they all thought I was Egyptian. Because apparently I looked really Egyptian in hijab, and so they automatically treated me like an equal. They all automatically treated me as an equal and started talking Arabic to me, and they thought I was Muslim. And it was just this instant inclusion into the culture. And then they would answer these questions, and I learned that these women were the heads of their families. It's like in My Big Fat Greek Wedding, she says that the man may be the head of the household, but the woman is the neck.
Okay.
And that's really what I found, was that these women were smart and educated and empowered and strong and independent. And I realized that they were empowered by this religion, by wearing hijab. And I learned the difference between culture and religion. Cultural things that happen with Islam, like women being stoned, like women, female circumcision and things like that. Those have nothing to do with Islam. They have to do with the cultures. And so once I started learning the difference between the culture of Islam and the faith of Islam, I became very attracted to the faith. Because, again, I had needed more structure in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd always had problems with Christianity, with the idea of not being accountable for my actions,
mm-hmm.
with this idea of a clean slate as long as you're saved. As long as you believe in Jesus, you're A-okay. I'd always had a problem with this kind of clean slate mentality. And in Islam, it's very much individual accountability for your actions. And it's also very much between you and God. That was been a problem that I'd found with Christianity, especially in Catholicism, where I'd needed an intercessor between me and God.
Mm-hmm.
And with this, it was just God and me, and it was just my faith. But it was this structure and this community that I'd always been looking for. So I took Shahada, which is the declaration of faith that makes you a Muslim. And I was not married to a Muslim. I was actually engaged to an atheist at the time. And as I became Muslim, my family took it very hard. My father didn't speak to me for 6 months. He was convinced that I was going to hell. My mother thought that I was crazy as a woman because she's very much a feminist. She didn't understand a lot of the things that I'd come to understand. And she was very judgmental. And about a year and a half later, I met my husband online. I decided that I wanted to marry a Muslim, because I needed that support in my faith. And I met my husband online through a Muslim wedding website where you meet other Muslims. And we got to know each other very well. We talked online, we talked on the phone. And after 3 months, he came out and proposed the first time we met face to face. And then we got married, we eloped. And that was in 2006. I was Muslim in 2004, October 2004. And the rest, I've just, you know, it's different with the cultures. That's the hard part, is the cultures. Because, like I said, there's a difference between culture and religion, and I may follow the religion, but I don't know how to cook lamb the way he wants, the way that he's used to. And I don't know the proper cultural things about, you know, which hand to eat with, and all of those things. And so it's a journey every day, but I'm lucky because we do have such a strong community that helps me learn and is very non-judgmental. I'm trying to learn Arabic. It's so difficult. Arabic is so completely foreign.
Yeah.
I mean, the alphabet, there's absence of letters. There's letters that my voice doesn't know how to make the sound. So it's very difficult. But I know enough Arabic to pray. And that's really the most important part. It's also, women can be empowered politically. I mean, Islam was the first religion to grant women the right to inherit. It also was the first religion to ban female infanticide. It also it gives women the right to be educated, and it encourages women to be educated.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are a lot of very empowering things, but it's not separate but equal. There's certain things that it's recognized that, you know, women are nurturers. And I think that that's an okay thing. I think that men can be nurturing. My husband is the most amazing father I've ever seen. In a lot of ways, he's much more patient with the baby than I am. And, I mean, I still work to support my family. But, I mean, there's certain things biologically I can nurse him, and my husband can't. And
right.
So
sure.
It's recognizing that there's certain bonds that even feminists have acknowledged, as far as there's certain bonds that to a mother that are inherent just biologically and hormonally, but men and women can definitely switch roles. But again, that's more cultural, not
right.
religious. There's nothing in Islam prohibiting a woman from working, and there's nothing in Islam prohibiting a man from staying home with his children. but it's just culturally it tends to be reversed.
Right. Mm-hmm. If you go to mosque here, what's that like for it being in this modern culture? Do people like wear jeans or?
Oh yeah. It will. The only thing that you're required to wear at the mosque, women should cover their heads. But you'll see women covering their heads with regular hats or bandanas or hoods, you know, hoodies. It depends on the woman. The thing that's required is modesty, you know, no images, no short sleeves, you know, longer sleeves, jeans. I wear jeans to the mosque all the time. I mean, it's right down the street. I'll just throw on whatever I have. Are you making noise? It's much more modern, but then in Morocco, everybody wears very long robes to the mosque, but it's just a much more traditional culture. Here, you'll see incredible diversity. You'll see women wearing Indian clothing, jeans, pants, tunics, robes, burqa. I mean, you'll see just an incredible diversity, and that's why I really like being Muslim in America, is that there's a far more diverse culture. So it doesn't feel, you get this mixture, like you'll just even the difference in hijab that Bosnians wear versus the hijab that Indian or Pakistani sisters will wear.
Okay.
There's just there's an incredible diversity. And I love it. That was the thing that attracted me so much to Islam, is that you can find a Muslim in any place. And I travel, you know, I've traveled the world as a Muslim wearing hijab. I've been to, you know, Europe and not long, but I was in, you know, airports in Europe, and even there, if you see another Muslim, I mean, you've never met this person in your life, and they'll come up to you and say, Salaamu Alaikum, and, you know, the sisters will come up and kiss your cheeks, and it's this universal sisterhood that we have that I never had with any other faith, so it's great.
And raising your son, how's that going to be different from how traditional American boys are raised?
Well, I mean, there's certain things. Things, for example, Muslim men don't go to the bathroom standing up. So, because it's messier and it's supposed to be much cleaner, so he'll learn how to do that sitting down.
Okay.
There are also, he's not going to celebrate things like Christmas. In Islam, we don't celebrate American holidays. Everything changes when Islam, he'll learn to pray very young. He already prays with me. I hold him in my arms while we pray. So it's something that's instilled at a very young age to do. And one of the beautiful things is that you'll see young children, 2 or 3 years old, praying along with their parents. And it's a much more focus on faith. And I think that instead of being focused on things like parties and materialism and things like that, there's a much more spiritual focus in raising a child Muslim. It's just, I believe it's the same values. I think that values are universal. It's just the practice that is different. So I think the same values are going to be instilled in any religion. It's just it's a much more focused and spiritual faith, I think.
We'll be right back with Ana Maria's interview with Marissa Kali. They spoke in Boise last December for Yin Radio, and our topic today on Yin Radio is sacred. Marissa has been talking about why she converted to Islam, about wearing hijab in Idaho, and about prayer. Now, as we rejoin the interview, Ana Maria asks her about stereotypes of Muslim women.
What is one stereotype that you deal with most?
Women being oppressed.
Sure.
When my best friend has worn hijab for a very long time. She's been Muslim for 17 years. She's worn hijab for 15 years. Been in Idaho and up in Seattle. So been in the Northwest. And she said that this woman, after 9/11 and after Afghanistan was invaded and the Taliban fell, this woman came up to her and said, "You can take that off now. You're free. We freed you." And that's the biggest misconception. I think the one that I deal with most frequently is they think that I became Muslim for my husband.
Mm.
Or the most common question is, "Where are you from?" And I'm like, "Idaho?" No, where are you from originally? I'm like, "Idaho Falls." So the biggest misconception is that there's two, is that first of all, Islam is kind of supplanted. It's not where it started. It's not something that is here and that is, you know, that is, you know, that's original. That it's kind of this idea that it's this foreign embodiment that's invaded America, and that you can't be this kind of idea that you can't be an American Muslim because you have to be Muslim then American. You can't be an American then a Muslim. And that's one that I deal with a lot. And then also just this idea that women are oppressed, that, you know, women have no choice, that they're forced to be at home, that they're forced to wear hijab. And hijab is a choice. I mean, we believe that, yes, you should wear it. It's in the Quran to wear it. But if a woman chooses not to wear it, that's between her and God. Her husband has no right to require her to wear it. Mm-hmm. And nobody should judge her for not wearing it. It's completely her decision. And I think that a lot of people don't understand that Islam is full of choices. And the third one is, of course, that Islam is a bunch of terrorists. Nice. And that's the one that's universally dealt with by male or female.
Yeah.
So.
So do you follow Sharia law?
Sharia law, we try to, but the thing you have to understand about Sharia law is that it's very misunderstood. Sharia law is not supposed to be universally applied.
Okay.
Sharia law is tempered by situation and circumstance. So you'll even see the information. There is no Sharia law is only supposed to be exercised in a perfect Islamic state. And we don't have a perfect Islamic state, so therefore Sharia law has no business being exercised in places where it's supposed to be tempered. It's supposed to be community oriented. And for example, the Prophet Muhammad, a woman came to him and said, you know, I had an affair. Please stone me. And he said, well, you're a mother. Go take care of your child instead. And he would keep sending her away every time she would come back because she was looking to be punished.
Mm-hmm.
And under Sharia, strict Sharia law, she was supposed to be punished. But there's always these gates that have to be gone through. For example, this idea of cutting off your hand if you steal. Well, in Sharia law, if you steal an apple to feed yourself, then that's not your fault. That's the community's fault for not taking care of you. Mm-hmm. And they should never cut your hand off. And it's there's like certain circumstances that have to be met. Like if you steal for absolutely purely selfish reasons, then you have to be punished. But how are you going to be punished? You know, cutting your hand off is in a lot of ways symbolic of, you know, removing your ability to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with eye for an eye, murdering. There's very much an idea of reciprocity in Islam. So following Sharia law means that you have to look at individual circumstances, and you have to look at what's best for the community. And in situations where women are being stoned for being, for having an affair, I mean, I don't believe that those are, you know, this is me as an American Muslim, and this is the idea of a lot of Muslims. That's not Sharia being properly executed. It has to be specific. So it's not Islam. There's two parts to Islam, and this is what a lot of people don't understand, is that there's the universal Islam, but Islam in most of the Quran and in most of the Hadith, it's meant for specific situations. It's not meant to be all-encompassing.
Mm-hmm.
For example, people will always read into Islam this idea that, you know, it says kill the infidels. Well, you have to look at the specific verses in the Quran that say that, that mention that, are in about very specific circumstances. It's talking about one specific battle in Islam. And it's not meant to be interpreted for universal. And that's the same way with Sharia law. So, I mean, Sharia law is about following reciprocity, it's about following fairness, it's about following community involvement. The community is responsible for the individual, not just the individual. And so there's much more, following the idea of spirit of Sharia law is great, but following the specifics is not in this situation. Tragedy of these other cultures is that women don't even understand their own rights in Islam. And that's why I also believe in education, because I believe that women need to be educated about what their rights are. And I think that if women knew what their rights in Islam were, then we wouldn't hear about so many of these things. Things like female circumcision, that's not Islamic. it's something that happens in cultures, but in nowhere in Islam does it talk about female circumcision.
Right.
My mom had what I called not without my daughter syndrome, because she'd seen that movie 100 times.
Okay.
And so when I became Muslim, and when I went to Morocco with the baby, she practically had a heart attack. She was convinced that my husband was going to take the baby, and that I was never going to see him again, and that I was never going to be able to escape, and that she was going to have to fly to Morocco to rescue me. And until I was back safely in the States, I think she truly believed that. And unfortunately, that's what happens in a lot of... I didn't see that particular video, but that perspective is what happens. You know, when I was studying Islam, there was a lot of those perspectives. And I think that they're universally the case is, again, it needs to be studying culture. And as an anthropologist, that's what I study, is culture. And there has to be a strict separation between culture and faith. And also between faith and actions. Faith and religion, there's a huge difference between faith and religion. Islam is a faith. And the problem is that a lot of religious people will mess it up.
Yeah.
Just like Jerry Falwell sometimes, you know, create a bad idea of Christianity. The Ku Klux Klan can create a bad idea of Christianity.
Yeah.
The Crusades create a bad idea of Christianity. You know.
It's always the radicals that speak the loudest, unfortunately.
Exactly. And the thing is that they may speak the loudest, but they don't have the most voices. And that's what people have to remember.
How would you like to see public perspectives change?
I just would like people to be educated. And there's the problem. I don't have a problem with people who aren't educated. I have a problem with ignorance. People who choose to be uneducated and will choose to remain ignorant, those are the ones that are messing with everything. Those are the biggest problem. And that's why I believe that outreach and education, we call it dawah, is so important. We don't believe in forcing people to believe in Islam. We don't believe in proselytization. You'll never see us knocking on doors.
Mm-hmm.
We believe in education, and if you choose to learn more, that's your choice. We're there to give people the opportunity to ask questions. And that's the biggest thing I'd like to see change, is that people being willing to ask questions instead of buying the status quo, instead of buying the party line. I'm a big Chomsky fan, so I believe that, you know, the media does have a way of making things skewed. And I'd like to see people ask for the truth. I'd like people to ask for the truth, but I'd like people to be responsible for themselves for finding the truth as well. And education is the biggest part, and it's the most important thing that we can do. His future is the most important thing to me. I'd like to see him live in a world where he can, you know, he doesn't have to worry about being called a terrorist, or he doesn't have to worry about getting on a plane, because people recognize that he's a Muslim, and that's not a bad thing.
That was Marissa Colley and her baby boy. She's an Idahoan and a Muslim woman. She serves as an outreach coordinator for the Islamic Center of Boise.
My sweet little religion.
We're exploring the sacred today on Yin Radio, and religion is often related. Our next piece is from the Tibetan Buddhist religion. I've aired parts of my interview with the Venerable Thubten Chodron in the past. In fact, last week's show, we talked about women in the media. During the same interview that I had conducted with her in November 2007, she talked with me about the Buddhist deity Tara. Now, the same as with our last piece, this woman, Thubten Chodron, is an American woman. She grew up in the Western U.S., and grew up in a typical American way with a typical American background. But she found a different spiritual path. Thubten was drawn to Tibetan Buddhism as a young woman, and now has been a Buddhist nun for more than 30 years. She founded and leads the Savrasti Abbey in Northwest Washington. She's written several books. She does interfaith work, and she works with prisoners, and she gives talks around the world. Here's Buddhist nun, the Venerable Thubten Shudren, talking with me about a sacred symbolic figure in Tibetan Buddhism, Tara.
Tara, the Liberator, mm-hmm. is the subject of one of your books, How to Free Your Mind. I know it's not the most recent, but it may be appropriate for women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At least in the fact that Tara, the goddess, if you will, uh-huh. is feminine, mm-hmm. deity, feminine manifestation of the Buddha. Now, that's what I understand her to be, a feminine manifestation yeah. of the Buddha.
Right.
But how do you describe her? Who is she?
Okay. So who is Tara? Yeah. Okay, so you're right. She's a feminine manifestation of the Buddha. And you see, the Buddha's omniscient minds, we can't communicate with them directly, so they appear in different forms because we are creatures we relate to forms. So, you know, a Buddha's omniscient mind appears in the form of Tara. Actually, there's over 108 manifestations of Tara. They all look different, but appear in all these different forms because the forms themselves communicate the realizations of an enlightened one. Okay. So, for example, Tara is green. Yeah. Well, we're sitting here now. There's a lot of snow around. Do you know what this place looks like in springtime when everything's blooming and it's all green? It looks totally different. So when you have greenery, you have this feeling of growth and success and things are moving. And so when you meditate on Tara, it brings you that kind of feeling, you know, of clearing away obstacles, of internal growth. Tara is sitting with her right hand outstretched. Okay, her left hand is held in the gesture of refuge at her heart. She's not sitting with her arms crossed in front of her. Okay, when we sit with our arms crossed in front of ourselves, we're, you know, positioning ourselves or we're protecting ourselves. But instead, she's open and her right hand is reaching out, you know, kind of reaching out, saying, "Hold my hand, I'll take you to enlightenment." I mean, that's a figurative thing. We don't really do that. Her right leg is stretched out as if stepping into the world to be of service. Her left leg is tucked in, showing that she has control of all of her own energies and her own emotions. Okay? So just by the way she's sitting, it gives some feeling to us. Okay? There's some kind of balance between being innerly at peace and outwardly of service. Okay? There's the feeling of growth and expansion. There's another form of Tara that's white. Okay? She's sitting in the Vajra position with both of her legs crossed. Okay? And she's white. And her speciality, she symbolizes long life. Okay, so the clearing away of diseases and anything that could shorten life. Yeah, then there's red Taras and black Taras and, you know, all different sorts of manifestations of Tara, but they show, like, different qualities of an enlightened mind. Okay?
So she can be in idols or statues of her can be very symbolic.
Yes. Yeah, the images are symbolic. We do not worship idols, okay? We don't bow down to statues for the sake of bowing down to statues. That isn't very meaningful, is it? But rather, when we see a statue or an image, it's like carrying a picture of a loved one with you, okay? When you're far away from home, you have to take out a picture of your family, and it reminds you of what they're like. When we see the images of the Buddha or of Tara, it reminds us of those enlightened qualities. So we're not worshiping the idol or anything like that.
And in Hinduism, I've been told from Hindu friends that the statues are, in some cases, thought to be a vehicle in which the actual deity comes and lives. Mm-hmm. I don't understand that to be true with Buddhism. Mm-hmm. But
well, we might talk sometimes about invoking the Buddha's mind into a statue. But it's not then that you think, oh, the statue's alive and the Buddha's there. And it's not like that. It's more, It's more just a tool for us to remember the qualities of a Buddha. Yeah,
I understand that. And I appreciate that explanation, because it's hard, especially for the kind of Christian I was raised,
mm-hmm.
Who didn't have any idolatry, the symbology was very, very limited, and mm-hmm. it was pretty much, it was non-Catholic, Catholic-like symbols.
Yeah.
The version of Protestants I was didn't have symbols. it's very unclear about what that all means.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems incredibly valuable.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah, and it's important in these things to really study and learn what the symbolism is, mm-hmm. and learn about these particular manifestations of the deity, learn the practices and why we do them and how to think when you're doing them, because we're not just taking away God and putting in Tara. No. There's a very different way of thinking about these various Buddha figures. Yeah.
And the Taras, and any other of the Buddha figures, I'm sure, mm-hmm. Seem to be examples to emulate.
Exactly.
So it's not so much, and I'm telling you what I think, of course,
mm-hmm.
not so much that it's a removed deity, unattainable,
exactly.
I can become.
Uh-huh. Right. And we say that there's different ways to relate to these Buddha figures or deities. And one way is that they are a role model for us, and they are the Buddha that we will become in its manifest form. Okay? So that we stop feeling like, you know, the spiritual perfection is like zillions of miles away and it's unattainable and all we can do is worship it. Not like that at all, but rather, you know, we can become Tara. You know, we can develop that infinite, impartial love and compassion for each and every living being. We can develop the wisdom that realizes reality. Yeah, we can become fully generous and ethical and patient and kind. And so it very much is a role model and a symbol of what we can become. Yeah. So that's one way. Another way to see these various Buddhas is simply as qualities. Yeah, not as persons or personalities, but as manifestations of qualities. Okay. So if compassion and wisdom and joyous effort, you know, were to appear in a physical form, what would it look like? Okay? So then you see how these manifestations express the qualities in symbolic language.
I have a Tara from my recent visit to Nepal, and I just was drawn to her. I
mm-hmm.
don't know why.
Yeah.
She's sitting with her feet in the position you described.
Uh-huh.
And I'm thinking, I get left and right mixed up, but I'm thinking this is the hand. The left is extended. I might be wrong.
No.
It would have to be the other.
It's usually the right, okay. That's extended
and
the left.
Instead of being right in front of the heart, it's more open. And I was told that was a teaching position.
Well, sometimes, yeah, this is teaching.
Yes.
Yeah, this is teaching. This is the three jewels, the mudra of refuge. So this is teaching. But you'll notice that she has lotuses blossoming. Yeah. So that's kind of like our Buddha nature blossoming.
Mm-hmm. She's just very attractive.
Yeah.
I love her.
Right.
A little meditation altar.
Right. And I think what's so nice is you look at Tara, and she's completely comfortable with her body. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's interesting too. She is, she's not covered and hidden, and denying her body. She's there. She's with it.
Right, but she's also not showing it off, mm-hmm. and thinking that everybody will like me because of my body.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. There's a lot more to her than
yeah. Yeah. Exactly. You know.
I read from the publisher of that of the book,
uh-huh.
Free Your Mind, Tara the Liberator. This apparently is an excerpt that you had written.
Mm-hmm.
Ever since Lama Thubten Yeshe first introduced me to the meditation practice Green Tara in 1975,
mm-hmm.
I was attracted to this Buddha.
Although all Buddhas have the same realizations, Tara's appearance was very friendly and welcoming. While my mind would sometimes project itself, created authority issues on other Buddhas, admitting my imperfections to Tara didn't bother me. And fortunately, I came to feel this way about other enlightened ones too. Was her female form what was so accepting of your imperfections to you?
I think so. And you know, Lama Yeshe, he used to call Tara Mummy Tara, because he said that people often feel more at ease with their moms, and they feel like they can open up and confide in their mothers, that somehow they feel, and you see this, you know, whether it's your mother or not, men and women alike often feel like they can talk about what's going on inside of them much more freely and openly to a woman. So I think Tara's appearing in that female manifestation, you know, made it easier. And I think also because I was a woman, I felt like, okay, you know. So even though I was projecting onto Tara that she's a woman, in actual fact, Buddhas are beyond being men and women, still it was a skillful method to help my mind at that time. And feeling like, okay, she'll understand where I'm coming from. And then that process of being able to open up, instead of keeping everything inside, feeling like we have to go to give a good image and be perfect to everybody. Just that feeling of just opening up, I think itself is very healing for us.
The Venerable Thubten Chödrön, founder of the Savrasti Abbey outside of Newport, Washington. She spoke with me in November 2007 at the Abbey. Now let's end this show on an appropriate note. The song is called Sacred, and it's by singer-songwriter Amel Lirel.
Is there nothing sacred anymore? When celebrities are deified, and we're still calling some countries third world, and crimes against little ones are punished with little laws, and girls are taught hide their curves as though they're flaws. Other girls are taught to expose them, but not on them, man. Boys are taught taking on it all. Is there nothing sacred anymore? It's the 21st century, and I still get followed around his door. And governments use our money for reasons other than what they say they're using it for. And small countries fold as the big debt keeps on growing, and silent pain is golden under the guise of religion. And boys are taught taking on it all. Thank you. all.
You can listen to past shows, or you can podcast this show, or sign up for electronic newsletter at yinradio.org. You can also find Yin Radio on MySpace or on Facebook. You can drop us a line at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's yinradio at V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP. It's Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho. And it's heard on Boise Community Radio at radioboise.org and on other stations around the whole country. Yin Radio is a production of VP Foundation, and I'm your executive producer and host, Sandy Billings. I'm glad you could join me. Until next week.